For many school districts, competing mandates from state leaders and local health officials are leaving parents and teachers and kids in limbo. The latest today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Our conversation with the superintendent of El Paso ISD on the practical challenges of reopening public schools. More on a newly unveiled proposal to cut $130 million from state health services as the coronavirus fight continues. 5 years after the death of Sandra Bland, the mark she left at her alma mater, and on a movement. Also, the week in politics with the Texas Tribune and more when the Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 17th day of July, 2020. I'm David Brown. Happy Friday to you and yours as we enter another weekend in the fight against the coronavirus. Here's where we stand. 10,457 Texans in hospitals across the state trying to beat COVID-19. 3,561 deaths now attributed to the virus statewide, and nearly 20% of those deaths were reported in the past week alone. These numbers have been compiled by the Texas Tribune, and a little later in the broadcast, we'll be hearing about chatter on social media regarding the possibility of a second shutdown in Texas. Rumors about that have been swirling on social media all week. For parents and public school students, the ticking of the clock is getting louder. What happens in the fall? Only last week, the Texas Education Agency, the TEA, was saying all Texas public schools would have to open with on-campus classes in the fall for students who want it, while giving schools a 3-week transition period at the start of the school year to conduct classes online only. Well, this week, Governor Abbott hinted that the state would be more flexible with reopening, and the TEA said online-only classes could be extended in districts without a loss of state funding if local health officials declared it unsafe to go back to school in their areas. Which leaves us where exactly? Some school administrators are quite unsure what to do, and they've been trying to craft plans on their own, sometimes not squarely in line with the black letter rules from the state. We've been talking with local superintendents to hear how they are trying to make plans amid all this. Joining us today is the superintendent of El Paso ISD, Juan Cabrera. Superintendent Cabrera, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Earlier this week, the El Paso Times was reporting that local health authorities were warning against a school reopening in September, and a lot of schools have been looking at you and your plans to see what you come up with. So what are your plans for reopening, at least as it stands?
Well, first of all, I want to say that we are very much working with the county health authority and director. We're the largest employer in town, so what I decided to do was, before we gave our final plans, was to sit with the mayor, the county judge, and the county health director and said, listen, I'm not happy with the way many districts are acting completely in silo. Let's try to work together as a county and think about what's best for our county. You know, we only have 800,000 people in the county, 200,000 kids in K-12 schools, and 30,000 employees. So when we start moving, when that domino falls, the entire county is impacted. So we're able to work with the county to put this health order together. But honestly, this is a day-to-day decision for us. We're on a daily basis speaking with the folks in Austin and senior officials in El Paso.
Just to be clear, it's not just that El Paso ISD needs to figure out what to do in the fall. You have other independent school districts nearby, and they're going to be profoundly affected by what you do.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have actually 12 school districts we serve in that region, and that's where the 200,000 or so kids reside amongst those 12 districts.
So tell us a little bit about what now parents can expect in El Paso.
Well, so we're looking at this in basically there'll be four tranches. There'll be kids that choose face-to-face, and they'll come in each 2 days a week and 3 days at home. That's our A and B groups. C is virtual full-time, so our C group will not come in the buildings at all. Then our D group is what we're going to call kids with special needs and any kids that are so far behind academically or have other barriers to virtual school that we're going to bring them into the building first. Mm-hmm. So serve those with the greatest needs, whether they be physical, academic, or otherwise, first. fill up the rest of the buildings with our A and B kids and then teach our virtual.
I want to be perfectly clear about when the doors will be open on campuses. Will that be on the first day of school or no?
Right now, it's Tuesday, September 8th. That is our current plan. But of course, we've got the caveat in all of our plans that, you know, safety and health permitting, and that is to say that we are going to maintain social distancing. We've got a bit of a conundrum with the state when they say every parent that wants to be in a school gets to be in a school. And if you think about it, that doesn't necessarily juxtapose well with social distancing mandates.
Right.
So we're going to allow and try to accommodate every family that wants to be in the building. But social distancing and protecting our teachers and staff is of utmost importance.
I guess there's something else that you're trying to keep an eye on, and that's school funding, because, of course, those determinations are largely made on attendance. What's the latest that you're hearing when it comes to how you're going to do those head counts and how much money you might lose depending on how the situation unfolds?
Well, we are so concerned about that, sir, that we have actually reorganized. I'm going to create a team that does nothing but manages the new attendance rules, because we used to count everybody at 10 a.m. under pre-corona. Now we've got an assortment of rules around face-to-face, synchronous, and asynchronous instruction. So it's complicated. In fact, there were 18 pages of that in the last order that came out. My expectation is that today, the commissioner and the governor will announce an extended window of virtual, again, at our choice. I think that's going to go from 3 weeks to 2 months is what I'm hearing. And once we get that extended window, then we have, of course, more flexibility. But then again, once that 8 weeks or whatever time period is up, then the more stringent rules will come into place. And you're exactly right. Teachers, administrators, everyone needs to understand, as long as we have that mandate, we're going to have to be really careful about the way we manage attendance and keep track of it, because those are real dollars that support instruction and jobs.
An enormous challenge for Juan Cabrera and staff over at El Paso ISD, where he's superintendent. Mr. Cabrera, thanks again for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Back in May, Texas's top three lawmakers, Governor Greg Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, and House Speaker Dennis Bonin, gave a directive to state agencies to cut 5% of spending in their current two-year state budgets. The cuts are a direct response to the economic crisis created by the coronavirus pandemic. A recent proposal from the Texas Health and Human Services Commission aims to cut $130 million in health services from the current budget. Quote, whittling away dollars in women's health, child abuse protection, and services for adults and children with disabilities, so writes Julie Chang, an investigative reporter for the Austin American-Statesman. And Julie joins us now. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much, David.
When you write women's health, child abuse protection, and services for adults with disabilities, what types of programs are we actually talking about here?
So in the proposal that the Texas Health and Human Services Commission sent to top leaders, some areas are more specific than others. So we have more clarity on some programs over others. In terms of things like women's health and family violence prevention programs and services for individuals with traumatic brain injuries, these are areas that are cited in the proposal to be cut, but we don't have too many details about that. In some areas, they do cite cutting regulation services. So that would mean oversight for certain, like child welfare services, adult protective services. It seems like they are targeting a lot of staff that could provide both oversight as well as processing of public benefits for needy Texans.
What about regulatory oversight when it comes to child protection? For instance, you know, daycare centers or foster care. What are you hearing about possible cuts there?
So the proposal highlights cutting positions as well as travel for staff members who provide investigations over child care centers like daycares, as well as, you know, foster care providers. And so this is particularly alarming because, you know, the Statesman investigation in 2018 found that children were dying under the oversight of daycares. The legislature last year passed several laws, including one that would establish a unit to investigate daycare abuse. And so if that's on the chopping block, which this proposal indicates it is, it could mean possible lack of oversight in daycares. And you know, this was something that it was highlighted as a huge problem statewide.
Well, with services like child abuse protection and the state's beleaguered foster care system, can the state make cuts to certain foster care services as a matter of law? I mean, that's been in the courts for some time.
Yes, that has been. And I think that's the big question of whether the state can both cut away dollars from child protective services and still maintain the legal requirements of ensuring that children are protected, children are seen in timely manner if there's an accusation of abuse or neglect. I think that a lot of advocates are worried that the agency can be able to both balance their fundamental service to the state as well as conserve money during this hard economic time.
Julie Chang is an investigative reporter for the Austin American Statesman. Julie, thanks again.
Thanks so much, David.
Monitoring the Talk of Texas on this Friday, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello, Wells.
Hello, David. Happy Friday to you there.
And to you.
The term Texas 21, TX21, trending on Twitter, as in Texas' 21st congressional district. It's one of four seats in Congress that the Cook Political Report has tipping from Republican to Democrat. That seat in Texas 21st is currently occupied by Representative Chip Roy, and his challenger is a name familiar to many Texas politics watchers, Wendy Davis. Cook Political Report sees the electorate in that district moving from lean Republican to a toss-up. On Twitter, Mr. Sarcophagus says, "Get 'em, Wendy, do it, girl." And over on our Facebook page, Chris Glenn notes that turning Texas 21 blue would be the perfect example of gerrymandering backfiring, referring to how that district was initially drawn to court suburban Republican voters. Just one of the stories we're watching, David. I'll be back with more later in the program.
One of many. We'd love to hear from you, dear listener. Reach out to us. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he'll be back in 35 minutes as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's been said many times that Tuesday's primary runoff election was something of a test run for November, and there were definite bumps in the road, from issues with mail-in ballots to stories of polling places shutting down at the last minute because of coronavirus fears among some election workers. And the experience for in-person voters? KERA's Mallory Falk reports.
El Pasoan Jacob Morales is what you'd call an enthusiastic voter. He spent the day of the runoffs texting his friends, reminding them to show up at the polls.
It's just important to hold everyone accountable for that.
Morales says he's already kind of comfortable leaving his house during the pandemic because he has to. He's a server at Topgolf.
Whoever's listening to this, please remember to tip your servers. They deserve it.
Still, he was nervous to show up in person at his polling place on the city's west side.
I was just kind of scared to see how it was going to go and everything.
Along with other voting locations across El Paso and Texas, his had taken precautions, like handing out Q-tips so voters didn't have to touch screens.
The measures that they're taking, they're actually very comforting.
Around the state, voters KERA spoke with said they were also impressed with the protocols at their polling places, like Courtney Hernandez, who cast her ballot at a Methodist church in Dallas.
We voted in the sanctuary, which is different than we normally vote at this location. Normally we're in the kids' classrooms, so there was a lot more space between us.
and Malcolm Beatty, who stopped by a community center in Fort Worth.
They all have sanitizer and wipes and everything, and even sanitizing the pens and whatnot as you use them.
The primary runoffs were a sort of trial run for the general election in November, a way to test out different safety measures. But election officials could only learn so much. Voter turnout is lower in primary runoffs. It's easy to maintain social distance and get in and out quickly when there isn't much of a line and when there isn't a lot on the ballot. With the presidency at stake, though, polling places will almost certainly be much more crowded. So is someone like Malcolm Beatty from Fort Worth nervous to vote in November?
No, I'm really not. For one, because I usually get up early and go vote. If I don't do early voting, then I make sure I get up early on the day of and get there before, you know, people get out and hit the polls.
Others are more concerned, including Linda Harrison from Austin. She is one of some 68,000 people who've tested positive for COVID since July 2nd, the deadline to register to vote by mail.
We're trying to do what the state of Texas and the federal government want you to do, which is to social distance and to stay away from people when you have the virus.
But as she told Texas Public Radio, the state didn't make it easy. The night before the election, she learned her test results weren't enough to receive an emergency absentee ballot. She needed a certified doctor's note. That led to a last-minute scramble, plus a lawyer who helped get her ballot in under the wire. The process didn't leave Harrison with much confidence.
If we've lost 137,000 people in the United States to date, what did they think it's going to be in November? And people are going to want to vote in the major election. If they find themselves in my shoes, are they not going to be allowed to vote?
What November will look like is still in the works. Voting in El Paso Tuesday, I met Blanca Martinez. She's 79 years old and told me she doesn't imagine anything will keep her from the polls this fall. Sure, it'll probably be more crowded, but she hopes it'll be more comfortable. This time, Martinez cast a ballot in the midst of a record-breaking heat wave and said the hardest part was wearing a mask while the temperature climbed. Her plan for November?
Temprano. Levantarse uno temprano para ser de los primeros.
Get there as early as possible. She plans to be among the first in line. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. If you've taken an economic hit because of COVID-19, the last thing you want to see is another big bill. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider has been looking at how residents in Texas's most populous county have been pushing back on property tax appraisals there during this pandemic.
Allison Tanton moved to a one-story ranch house in Houston's Lazy Brook neighborhood 3 years ago. Every year since then, she's seen her property taxes go up, and every year she's protested. This year, she suspected she might have to arrange her hearing remotely. Instead, she was pleasantly surprised.
This year, it's been easier because the past 2 years, I actually went to the hearing with HCAT in person.
By the time she requested a hearing this year, COVID-19 had already hit Harris County.
After I requested a hearing, I got an email of a settlement offer, even though I didn't ask for one. And they lowered what they were originally proposing, and so I accepted their new lower offer.
The Harris County Appraisal District, or HCAD, says it has been doing what it can to make the appraisal process easier during the pandemic.
We certainly are encouraging people to do things remotely and use the different options that we have provided.
Jack Barnett is HCAD's chief spokesman.
Even early on, we encouraged them by postings on our website and through social media to consider using iFile to file their protest rather than using a paper copy or trying to bring something into the appraisal district. We also encouraged them to use iSettle to be able to resolve their protest.
iSettle is the process where a homeowner can protest their appraisal online and accept a settlement offer without a hearing. But Houston Public Media confirmed it took HCAD roughly 3 months into the pandemic to offer the option of a remote hearing. As of early June, letters from HCAT to property owners said homeowners could accept an iSettle offer or protest in person.
As that has gone on and as the virus information has changed, we have continued to upgrade our systems and try to think outside the box and offer other alternatives for people, such as a remote hearing.
By mid-June, HCAT updated its website to include remote hearings. According to HCAT's records, the number of people who opted to use iSettle is up nearly 50% from July 2019. The number of people who've actually accepted their settlement offer rather than moving forward with their protests is up more than 50% over the same period. What's not entirely clear is why. Did people accept the settlements because they were satisfied or because they worried they might have to risk their health by protesting in person? Paul Betancourt, when he's not working as a state senator, is CEO of Betancourt Tax Advisors.
What was happening is that, surprisingly, the initial responses that people were getting on their automatic settlements, that was the vast majority of them were getting values lower than last year.
Betancourt says the lower offers are surprising because Harris County has some of the highest increases in property values.
So I think that's why those settlements increased dramatically, because the offers were low.
That said, homeowners typically can save more money by rejecting the iSettle offer and going forward with a protest hearing. The fact remains, a remote hearing wasn't an option well into June, long after the deadline for filing property tax protests passed on May 15th. People who'd initially arranged to protest in person can call HCAT to switch to a remote hearing, but that doesn't help those who had already settled. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, sharing that regular screenings like mammograms and colonoscopies are essential preventative appointments. Early detection of cancer often leads to better outcomes. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A report from the White House Coronavirus Task Force includes 123 Texas counties in a red zone that need tougher public safety measures. Davis Land reports all major Texas cities made the list.
The report was brought to light by the Center for Public Integrity. Areas listed in the red zone include places where there are more than 100 COVID-19 cases per 100,000 people and test positivity rates above 10%. In Texas, 51 metro areas are on that list, topped by Houston, Dallas, Austin, and San Antonio. The report recommends public officials require face masks, close bars and gyms, and limit gatherings to 10 people or fewer. It also puts emphasis on bolstering testing operations and making contact tracing quicker. Right now, Texas requires face masks and bars are closed, but gyms are still open at 50% capacity. I'm Davis Land in Houston.
County health officials across Texas are ordering schools to remain closed to in-person instruction through at least the beginning of September. The Texas Education Agency originally said school districts would lose state funding if online-only instruction went beyond the first 3 weeks of school, but it changed course this week amid surging COVID-19 cases, saying districts can remain closed if ordered by local health officials. Nueces County Health Authority Dr. Srikanth Ramachandruni took that step Thursday for Corpus Christi area schools.
School systems shall not reopen schools for on-campus, face-to-face instruction until after September 7, 2020. Virtual instructions shall be permitted as per school system's own plan.
Dallas County officials issued similar guidelines yesterday as well. Bexar County and San Antonio added a staggering 5,500 new positive COVID-19 cases Thursday night. Joey Palacios of Texas Public Radio's reports the high numbers are the result of a backlog of tests.
The tests were backlogged about 2 weeks, according to the San Antonio Metropolitan Health District. A new laboratory processing the test was incorrectly filing the data in a digital folder that the city's health department was not aware existed. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nirenberg says the city has experienced backlogs before, but this was frustrating.
When we're examining these data on a daily basis, we want to make sure that we're consistent, and the delays in these data is making that very difficult on us.
The county had been adding about 600 new cases per day over the last week. The sudden addition catapulted the total case count to more than 27,000. I'm Joy Palacios in San Antonio.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. True crime stories are seeing a resurgence these days, that is, if they ever went away. Unsolved Mysteries is back. Serial continues to be a big player in the podcasting world, and now there's a new player on the platform. The Orange Tree is a brand new podcast looking back at a murder near the UT Austin campus 15 years ago. It's co-reported and hosted by two recent UT journalism graduates, including Tanu Thomas. She's also a part-time producer at our home station, KUT in Austin. Tanu, thanks for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on your entry into the podcast world. Or maybe, have you done this before?
No, this is the first professional podcast I've worked on. I've dabbled in audio stories before during my time going to UT as a student, but this is the first professional podcast I've done.
And it's getting a lot of attention, too. Now, The Orange Tree is about the murder of Jennifer Cave. How did you first hear about this story?
I think the first time I ever heard about it, I was walking through West Campus with a couple friends during my first year there, and someone pointed up at the orange tree and said, "Have you heard about the murder that happens at this condominium complex?" From that point, it was just something that's always sparked an interest in my mind. I was always curious about the details of the crime, but it didn't really settle in as to what had happened there until my senior year at UT, when I looked into it for the first time.
You know, I think a lot of people know this story. There are probably a lot of listeners who don't know. The Orange Tree, is it a literal orange tree?
No, it is a condominium complex called the Orange Tree that is in West Campus. It's a mostly student-lived neighborhood near the University of Texas at Austin.
And what, just give us the broad outlines of what happened and why it got so much international attention at the time.
A young woman named Jennifer Cave, who was 21 years old at the time, she was about to start a new job at a law firm in town, and the day before she was supposed to start, she was murdered, and her body was discovered by her family at a condominium complex near the UT Austin campus. The two people that were involved were also UT students, and so this really shook the community, and the fact that everyone was so young that was involved, and the fact that the crime and what happened to Jennifer after she was killed was so heinous.
This was a highly covered story at the time, and it had a lot of sensational features, hard-to-believe features to it. Did you find it difficult to have something new to sort of tell in this story, or no?
My co-host Haley Butler and I got into this podcast because we wanted to tell the story from a younger perspective. We were 21 at the time, and we wanted to kind of capture the emotional aspects of it that were not really captured in the original coverage of this crime. There were also a lot of players that no one had ever heard from that we got to talk to in this podcast.
I would imagine it would be difficult to talk to family members about this, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that was one of the most emotional aspects of covering this crime. We had at that point connected so much to Jennifer. We were around the same age she was at the time of her murder. And we felt this like really strong connection to who she was as a person. We saw ourselves in her. We saw our sisters in her. And we saw our friends in her. We saw each other in her. So just talking to her family and hearing about what a big loss this was and how they still grapple with it to this day was incredibly painful. And it's still, I don't think it's something that we'll ever, you know, get over or forget. It's something that's going to stay with us for a long time. And hopefully our listeners will feel the same way.
It's interesting that we're seeing the emergence of podcasting, especially considering the fact that it is basically an oral medium. We're seeing a resurgence of this kind of storytelling.
I think the resurgence of podcasting, especially for this kind of storytelling, is really important because you get to hear the voices of those involved. And that was actually a really big selling point for us, for our sources, because, you know, when the story was originally covered, you got to hear from some of the people involved in this case on paper. Occasionally, you would see a news story that would be, you know, on the nightly news that day, and then it would disappear. But podcasting is this sort of permanent platform that you can always tune into, you can pause and get back to. It allows listeners to directly hear from the people involved without, you know, hearing from a reporter who is conveying what their source said. So that was a really big deal for a lot of our sources, to be able to have their voices actually heard telling their own story.
What do you hope to accomplish ultimately with this retelling?
Well, I think one of our biggest goals from the beginning has been for people to look at true crime stories differently after listening to this podcast. We did our best to try to tell it sensitively and to try to tell it from a perspective of the victim's family as well as every other player involved. So when you listen to a true crime podcast in the future, hopefully our listeners will be able to approach that with a new perspective.
Tanu Thomas is co-reporter and co-host, along with Haley Butler, of the new podcast, The Orange Tree. It's available now wherever you get your podcasts. Tanu, thanks again.
Thank you so much, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas A&M University, dedicated to making a college education available to all who seek it. Details about how Texas A&M fulfills its land-grant mission at keeplearning.tamu.edu. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The story of Prairie View A&M University, an historically black university, is forever intertwined with the story of the death of Sandra Bland. Bland was a Prairie View A&M graduate. In 2015, she was 28 years old and getting ready to move back to Texas from Illinois to start a job at Prairie View A&M. But she was pulled over on July 10th as she left campus. It was a minor traffic violation, failure to signal, yet Bland, a black woman, was arrested by a white DPS officer. 3 days later, she was found hanging in her cell. Her death was ruled a suicide. The road off Prairie View A&M University has now been renamed Sandra Bland Parkway. Here to talk more about the intertwined stories of Sandra Bland and Prairie View A&M is Professor Melanie Price. She is the author of The Race Whisperer, Barack Obama and the Political Uses of Race, and she is an endowed professor of political science at Prairie View A&M. Professor Price is also the director of the proposed Ruth J. Simmons Center for Race and Justice. Professor Price, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
Beyond that street name change I mentioned in 2015, mm-hmm. How has Sandra Bland's death affected Prairie View A&M?
Well, Prairie View, I should also say that it's my alma mater. Hmm. And so Prairie View has been politicized. The students have for a very long time, mostly around voting rights issues. We've had issues that have resulted in litigation and, in fact, Supreme Court cases that mention us about voting rights. And mm-hmm. So we were already a pretty politicized campus. Sandra Bland herself had marched in some of those voting rights marches. I think Sandra Bland has expanded the way in which they think about Waller County and its politics. So now they focus not just on voter suppression, but on the ways in which the students are habitually over-policed. The students are the largest, probably, block of voters in the county, but they are also systematically seen as somehow enemies of the county. So now they focus not just on people who are in charge of voting, but they also focus on people like the district attorney. They focus on people like the sheriff and how they get elected. And so they have thought about their relationship to county politics much more holistically.
I mentioned that proposed Center for Race and Justice, the Ruth J.
Yes.
Simmons Center. Is there mm-hmm. an intersection between Sandra Bland's story and the proposed Race and Justice Center?
Well, for sure. I mean, one of the things, it comes out of our president, Ruth J. Simmons, actually trying to figure out what we will do in this moment after the death of George Floyd. And really, for the past 7 years, you can count back to Trayvon Martin's death, Black people have been in the streets and have been protesting and have been writing and calling and demanding for people to listen to them about the ways in which their interaction, not just with police, but their interaction with prosecutors who fail to indict vigilantes who take violence into their own hands against Black people. And of course, every time one of these things happens, it leads our campus right back to Sandra Bland. It leads us right back to the moment in our own front yard. A member of our own Panther family was taken from us. And we think about Robbie Tolan, who is another student on our campus, who was shot by the police in his own driveway while his parents tried to explain to the police that he was, in fact, not stealing anything. I think the difference right now is that in this moment, more people seem to be listening. And that's where we step in. It's our job as educators. It's our job as an institution of higher learning to actually sort of help produce and frame the knowledge that people need to help them understand these moments better.
Why do you think this moment is different? What made it different?
We tend to think about civil rights and the press for civil rights on the part of African Americans as these burst moments. But Black people have been involved in a constant struggle since their presence on this continent. Sometimes they become bigger, though, when there are moments where there are other kinds of disruptions happening, too. So people are now trying to figure out, who is this America? Normal has disappeared. And while we're trying to solve and answer all those questions, this thing starts to happen again, where you start to see African Americans being hunted down in the streets by people who take it upon themselves to police their neighborhood. They're not police at all. And you start to see police behave in ways that clearly are inhumane. And while we're trying to figure out what America looks like post-pandemic, we're also having to solve what America looks like post-George Floyd.
Now, of course, there are campaigns that are getting a lot of attention, for instance, Black Lives Matter and the Say Her Name campaign.
Yes.
And I wonder how Sandra Bland's story echoes or resonates in those movements, as you see it.
Well, you know, there is a way in which Black women and their death at the hands of police sometimes get lost in these stories. And it often gets lost because we don't have lots of examples of these viral videos. The videos of George Floyd, the videos of Ahmaud Arbery, they stand out for you because you actually get to see the thing as it is happening. But the thing we know for sure about both Breonna Taylor and about Sandra Bland is that the people whose job it was to recognize their civil rights, whose job it was to care for them in their custody, somehow at the end of those interactions, they both ended up dead.
You were telling me a little bit earlier that you're an alum of,
yes, I am.
Of Prairie View A&M University. Mm-hmm. Does the story of Sandra Bland resonate for you personally? It must.
I mean, it does. I was living in the Northeast when the video, the police's dash cam, was released. And I know that street. It was the place where I became an adult. It was the place where I learned to love my university. I understand Sandra Bland's desire to come back to Prairie View. I get why she felt like she was home when she got there. I also knew that when you step off that campus, you are also then being policed by the sheriff. You're being policed by the local police. You're being policed by constables. You're being policed by highway patrol. I've driven up and down 290, and I've seen the way they stop students on 290 outside of Prairie View's campus. I understand the context in which Sandra Bland was stopped, and I understand that that could have been me. It could have easily been my sister who went to Prairie View. It could have easily been my niece and nephew. And so I take that very personally. People talk about the ways in which, oh, if Sandra Bland had been more complacent, if Sandra Bland had just listened to what the cop said. But I mean, Sandra Bland was a recent college graduate. And we think about young people in a very different way when they're Black. I've seen whole videos where white people have literally slapped cops in the face and didn't end up dead.
Professor.
And I'm wondering how that happens to Black people so often, where a bad tone then leads to you being in custody that then leads to your death.
I know that there have not been a lot of people on campus, especially during this pandemic. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But as we think back on 5 years after this incident, which shocked Texas, certainly shocked the world, what sort of mark do you believe it has left at Prairie View A&M beyond the street signs and that sort of thing?
So you go all over campus. There are pictures of Sandra Bland on notification boards. You know, I teach classes on Black politics. And in those classes, they bring up Sandra Bland. I say Sandra Bland represented the best of us. She was a person who stood up for her own rights. She was a person who wasn't afraid to speak out. She was a person who tried to pursue her dreams through higher education. And so that's what we do at Prairie View. You know, we produce a ton of your Black teachers. We produce a ton of your Black nurses. We produce more Black architects than almost any school in the country. And so when you think about us, you think about the best of Sandra Bland, not just her death, but the reason why she was there to live. And our students are keenly aware of that. They accept that Sandra Bland is one of us.
Melanie Price is an endowed professor of political science at Prairie View A&M. She is also director of the proposed Ruth J. Simmons Center for Race and Justice and the author of The Race Whisperer: Barack Obama and the Political Uses of Race. Professor Price, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Carrie Ann Holt, and I write poems on the spot with Typewriter Rodeo. We can be heroes. You hear a lot about heroes these days. The nurses, the teachers, the cashiers, the bus drivers, the delivery drivers, the poll workers, the meat packers, the moms, the dads, the single parents, the single people, the scared, the lonely, the kids stuck inside, the grandparents stuck inside too. And all of us, in between. Here's a wonder and a question for every one of us all. The last time you sang Land of the Free and Home of the Brave, did you think you'd ever take it so literally? And yet here we are, each of us in our own home of the brave, each of us fighting our way through the days, heroes all in each our own way. I'm Carrie Ann Holt with Typewriter Rodeo, and you are listening to Texas Standard.
Support for the Typewriter Radio comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
You can catch the Typewriter Rodeo each Friday here on The Standard, anytime on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to send us your Typewriter Rodeo requests on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org. We couldn't let a Friday come and go without checking in with Alex Samuels. She's political reporter for the Texas Tribune, and she's here to help us with the week that was in Texas politics. Alex, good to talk with you again. Welcome.
Yeah, always happy to be here.
The GOP state convention, after that back and forth over whether it would be face-to-face or virtual, kicked off online yesterday, but as I understand it from what the Tribune is reporting, with a pretty rocky start. What happened?
Yeah, so the convention was supposed to go live yesterday at 9 a.m., but there was an hours-long delay that I believe was due to its online credentialing process. And then last night, the party voted to postpone the convention a day, so they'll resume business on Saturday instead of today.
I see. But didn't Governor Abbott speak somehow at the convention, or was that just a preview that y'all got a hold of?
He did speak at the convention. He sent in a video. I believe he was the first statewide official to speak at the convention, and he talked a little about his coronavirus response and his mask mandate, and just, you know, sort of told delegates, you know, I know some of you guys are frustrated with this mandate, but this is what we have to do to help curb the spread of coronavirus in the state.
Now, this week, speaking of Governor Abbott, a super PAC in Texas was announced, and it's aimed directly at him. Tell us more.
Yeah, so the group is called the Beat Abbott PAC, which is hoping to harness the opposition to the governor's handling of the coronavirus pandemic to defeat him in 2022, which is the next time that Abbott is up for re-election. So the money that the group raises will go to whatever Democratic nominee is up against Abbott that year. And until then, the group hopes to build a small dollar donor list that can help Democrats in the next election cycle.
Interesting. So who exactly is behind it? Is it clear? I mean, you mentioned that this is supposed to benefit a Democratic challenger.
Yeah, so there's the PAC's board includes Tori Gravito, who I believe is the president and co-founder of Way to Win, a few folks who were involved in Beto O'Rourke's 2018 U.S. Senate campaign, and then other veteran labor and political operatives. But again, there's no telling who that Democratic opponent will be in 2022.
Is it clear he's vulnerable? I mean, or just how vulnerable the governor might be right now?
So if anything, the governor is in a very good position if he does decide to run for re-election in 2022. His campaign announced on Wednesday that he raised $7.6 million during the first half of this year and has nearly $38 million cash on hand.
Well, let's not leave the governor just yet, because I don't know if about you. I've been seeing a lot of stuff on social media, all in the realm of rumor, right? Having to do with another state shutdown. I recall one earlier this week, maybe it was Monday, saying after these elections, the governor's going to shut down Texas again. Of course, that didn't happen. At least it hasn't happened yet. Has the governor been trying to push back on any of that?
Yeah. So in a TV interview yesterday, he made clear that despite the rising number of coronavirus cases, that there is no shutdown looming. Of course, just last week, Abbott said that if people didn't abide by his statewide mask mandate and the spread of the virus didn't slow, then the next step would be a lockdown. But this week, he's striking a much different tone and emphasizing that rumors of an imminent lockdown are not true.
Alex Samuels is politics reporter at the Texas Tribune. You can read all about it over at texastribune.org. Alex, good to talk with you. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring social media on this Friday. Wells, we have a bit of an update on a story that we started the program with. Are you seeing this new information from the Texas Education Agency?
No, can't say I have, David. Fill us in.
Yeah, this is coming from the Dallas Morning News. Apparently, Texas public schools will be allowed to offer virtual-only instruction potentially as late as November, and high schools won't be required to offer 5 days of in-person instruction per week. That, according to Corbett Smith, reporting for the Dallas Morning News. Apparently, what this would require is school districts to submit plans and explain why it is that they would want to continue with online-only classes through November, and then you'd have to get approval from the TEA before you could actually implement those plans. But obviously, they're under a lot of pressure from school districts to do something about the situation, especially considering these record numbers that continue to be set daily here in Texas.
Yeah, as we heard, as we've been hearing all week in our conversations with superintendents and educators across the state, it's fascinating to hear this, David, and honestly, of a piece with what we've been hearing, a sort of slow sort of rollback of those initial announcements from the TEA mandating in-person school, all that stuff. So I wouldn't be surprised if we hear more, or quite honestly, if those dates keep getting pushed back. Well, circling back to what we were just hearing about folks sounding off about that persistent chatter, those rumors about another potential shutdown, and the governor's pushback to that, as you were just discussing. People are panicking, thinking I'm about to shut down Texas again, he said in that televised interview. The answer is no, that is not the goal. Interestingly enough, those comments, as was noted, came from an interview with a local TV station. That's really been the governor's preferred mode of communication during the pandemic. Susan Leviton on Facebook points that out and notes that he won't do a formal daily update like you've seen with, say, Governor Cuomo or someone like that. He just does media interviews, and you have to go and search for them to find out what he said on a particular day. Calls there for a more sort of concerted media address strategy from the governor's office. And as for the governor's remarks that people are panicking because folks think another shutdown is coming, Lindsay Nicole Morin, she says, no, people are panicking because so many are getting sick. And another, just one more thing about the governor's remarks there. I've seen some political prognosticators point out that you have to parse Greg Abbott's language pretty carefully sometimes, because he does leave a little bit of wiggle room in there. And that those four or five words, that is not the goal, another shutdown. Not ruling it out explicitly, just saying that is not the goal on his behalf. So obviously, developing situation we're going to have to watch and see, David.
And one we continue to follow here at the Texas Standard. Keep up with all the news 24/7 throughout the weekend over at texasstandard.org. And of course, we hope you will join us once again on Monday. Till then, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a terrific weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.